Acts 19:21 through 25, the 65th talk in a series on the Book of Acts, was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 20, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
See, I don't think my version has it, but there's some place in there where it talks about the man who's controlled by this unclean spirit, this demon, beats up on both of them. It uses the word both somewhere along the way. That's confusing. Who are the both if there are seven of them? The Greek word amphetteros means typically both, but it is very, very, very often used to mean all of them, each of them. So in all likelihood, it's actually all seven of them that get beaten up, even though some translations have both. But that's just an idiom in the Greek that I don't know why the translators did what they did. But we're going to go on now after the spectacle of the demon-possessed man beating up the conjurers. We're still in Ephesus in verse 21. Now after these, we're going to probably, if all goes well, cover quite a bit of ground. There's not a lot of heavy content in what follows, at least not that I am able to discern. So a lot of history here, a lot of storyline here. So I think I'll cut it up into chunks and just comment on it a chunk at a time. Now after these things were finished, Paul purposed in the Spirit to go to Jerusalem after he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia, saying, "After I have been there, I must also see Rome." And having sent into Macedonia two of those who ministered to him, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. Okay, just some of the geography here. Paul is in Ephesus. He's purposed in his spirit to go to Jerusalem. Purposed in his spirit, I think, means nothing more than simply he resolved to do so. It's a use of the word spirit, which is not uncommon in the Bible, where all it means is what we would call heart or mind or will, just the inner person. It's a normal, natural function of human rationality itself and of humanity itself. There's nothing supernatural here. It's not an allusion to anything supernatural here. Paul just simply decided in his own heart that he was going to go to Jerusalem. It's interesting. I mean, if you allow it to say what it's saying and don't try to spookify it, it is interesting that Paul has the perspective that you can simply assess the situation, decide what you want to do, and go do it. You know, there are people in certain Christian circles that insist on being led by the Lord in everything that they do. You know, I'm not going to move unless the Lord leads me. And it becomes a form of piety it becomes a kind of piety that we try to portray to one another. That's not where Paul's coming from. I mean, here's the situation. He doesn't receive a vision in this situation. He doesn't receive special instructions from God in this situation. He simply purposes within his own spirit. Here's what he wants to do. So Paul has been led by the Spirit more than any of us ever have been, led by the Spirit in the sense of supernaturally, by revelation and by visions. But he doesn't see that as the norm, I would argue. The norm is just like the norm for all of us. We try to wisely assess and judge a situation and do what we think is right. And that's what's being described here, I think. So his purpose is to go to Jerusalem. Luke does not make this clear, but if you take data from 1st and 2nd Corinthians and Romans and other passages, that other information that we get can put together from the letters, Paul's purpose in going to Jerusalem, the reason he purposed this, is that there is some report of economic problems, I believe, in Jerusalem. So Paul takes a group of people who have collected material resources to go to Jerusalem to help the poor in Jerusalem, the poor in the church in Jerusalem. So his resolve seems to be this mission. He wants to help the poor there. It's not simply to help the poor because they're poor, although that would certainly be sufficient reason enough, but there seems to be an element of what he wants to do. In fact, he comments on it, I think it's later in Acts, he'll comment on this, that he thinks that these Gentile believers that have been gathering in Asia and in Greece owe a huge debt of gratitude to the church in Jerusalem. And he sees it as a very important gesture on their part to make this significant and dramatic token of their gratitude and their appreciation to the church in Jerusalem. So that's his mission, to lead a group of people, and you'll see that there's some named people that he takes with him, to lead these named representatives of the churches all over Asia and Greece to Jerusalem with a gift to the poor in the church in Jerusalem to say, thank you, here we are, we wouldn't be here if it weren't for you. So that's his purpose, what he's resolved in his heart. And he's hell-bent on going to Jerusalem. We will see that he makes decisions based on this resolve to forego other opportunities, that this is a very important thing to him. But he's going to pass through Macedonia and Achaia. Macedonia, of course, is where Philippi, Berea, Thessalonica, those cities are what is now northern Greece, and Achaia is now the main southern part of Greece, which would include Athens and Corinth, although Athens seems to have dropped off the radar screen. So primarily we're talking about Corinth when we're talking about Achaia. So he wants to go visit these churches that have been established first. So that's his plan. I'm going to go visit them and apparently collect some representatives and then take them with me to go back to Jerusalem. Then, he's already thinking ahead, then I must go see Rome. We see in the letter to the Romans that his plan was even more extensive than that. He not only wants to go see Rome, but he wants to go on finally to Spain. So he has a strategy all mapped out here that he's resolved in his heart that he wants to pursue. But he doesn't leave yet. He doesn't see his job in Ephesus done yet. So he sends Timothy and Erastus on to Macedonia ahead of him, and he stays in Asia, that is to say, in Ephesus. Timothy, we know from 1 and 2 Timothy, he's the traveling partner of Paul that he writes those letters to. Erastus, we don't really know anything about. There is an Erastus that's mentioned in Romans 16:23, who's described as the city treasurer. We know that a number of people traveled with Paul over to Ephesus from Corinth. So it's very possible that Erastus is that person that's mentioned in Romans 16. Okay, then he goes on. About that time, there occurred no small disturbance concerning the way. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, was bringing no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen of similar trades and said, "Men, you know that our prosperity depends upon this business. You see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a considerable number of people, saying that gods made with hands are no gods at all. Not only is there danger that this trade of ours fall into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis be regarded as worthless, and that she whom all of Asia and the world worship will even be dethroned from her magnificence." When they heard this and were filled with rage, they began crying out, saying, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." The city was filled with the confusion, and they rushed with one accord into the theater, dragging along Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia. And when Paul wanted to go into the assembly, the disciples would not let him. Also, some of the Asiarchs who were friends of his sent to him and repeatedly urged him not to venture into the theater. So then, some were shouting one thing and some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and the majority did not know for what reason they had come together. Some of the crowd concluded it was Alexander, since the Jews had put him forward, and having motioned with his hand, Alexander was intending to make a defense to the assembly. But when they recognized that he was a Jew, a single outcry arose from them all as they shouted for about 2 hours, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." After quieting the crowd, the town clerk said, "Men of Ephesus, what man is there after all who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is guardian of the temple of the great Artemis and of the image which fell down from heaven? So since these are undeniable facts, you ought to keep calm and to do nothing rash. For you have brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples nor blasphemers of our goddess. So then, if Demetrius and the craftsmen who are with him have a complaint against any man, the courts are in session and proconsuls are available. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you want anything beyond this, it shall be settled in the lawful assembly. For indeed we are in danger of being accused of a riot in connection with today's events, since there is no real cause for it, and in this connection we will be unable to account for this disorderly gathering." After saying this, he dismissed the assembly. Okay, we have this very interesting scene about what amounts to a kind of riot. In reading this, it reminds me of the SDS meetings I went to back in the 60s, back in campuses during the Vietnam War, when they would routinely have people rioting and going out and breaking windows and wreaking destruction on the campus. And they would usually have a meeting for about 2 hours before that, where they would come together and practice participatory democracy. It was the most chaotic meeting I have ever been in my life, and this reminds me of that when Luke describes it. They didn't know why they were there. So then some were shouting one thing and some another, for the assembly was in confusion and the majority did not know for what reason they had come together. It points out this phenomenon in human experience, where that there really is a crowd psychology, a mob psychology that can take over in certain kinds of contexts, and that people's energy feeds off of the other energy, and there's nothing ultimately rational about it. It's not purposive, it's not organized, it's not goal-oriented, there's no real point to it. It's just, whatever it is, this is exciting. And you jump on the background, on the bandwagon, and off you go. Typically, the people who did the most destructions in the campus riots were the high school kids from Pali High next door who were just along for the ride. They had no ideology whatsoever. It was just, there's a riot going on tonight, let's go have some fun. If it weren't so destructive, it would be hilarious. But that's the kind of psychology that can take over, and it seems to be that's what's going on here in Ephesus. You not only have these craftsmen, these tradesmen, who do have a bona fide concern that they want to address, but their energy has attracted other people from the city, and they've flooded into the Ephesian amphitheater, which was a huge place, held about 25,000-30,000 people, and are they're just out of their minds with this energy for 2 hours. For 2 hours, just because the dude that they put up in front of him is a Jew and not a worshiper of Artemis, they just shout him down for 2 hours, saying, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." Well, you got to be out of your mind to not get bored saying that for 2 hours. But that's very believable. I mean, we see those kinds of mob phenomena. So, what lies behind this is Demetrius is the spearhead of a group of craftsmen in silver who created these little, he calls them shrines. They were these little, statue-like things of the goddess Artemis within some kind of religious context, religious setting. And they were just simply implements of the worship of this goddess Artemis. If you know Greek mythology and you know the Greek pantheon of gods, there is an Artemis in that pantheon. This goddess is not that goddess. And that's, notice that they say, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." probably that's the title they use to distinguish this Artemis from the Artemis of the Greek pantheon. It's a different goddess. Apparently, Artemis of the Ephesians was a goddess who had an ancient religious practices associated with her in the Asian region that had gone way back into fairly ancient times. And with the Hellenization, the Greek conquest of this region, they simply identified this goddess as Artemis and worshipped Artemis of the Ephesians here. Apparently a sort of fertility goddess. They talk about an image falling down from heaven. Scholars speculate that it was probably, in fact, I think they have other sources that indicate it was a meteorite that had come to Earth near there, and they had associated that in some way with Artemis of the Ephesians. So they had this meteorite, they had this temple. The temple was one of the wonders of the ancient world. I guess it was an amazing, magnificent temple. People from all over the Roman world, the empire, would come on pilgrimages to see this temple. So all that they report here appears to be very faithful to the history that historians and archaeologists have been able to uncover. The Artemis of the Ephesians was a big deal to a lot of people in the Roman Empire. So much so, according to this account, that their economy was based on it. This was a big, big part of Ephesian economy, was meeting the needs and getting the revenue from people who had come to visit the temple and in one way or the other take part in the worship of Artemis, including buying these little silver shrines that the silversmiths made. Well, business is dropping. And the reason business is dropping is because Paul has come into town and has proclaimed the gospel, and the gospel is beginning to have a huge impact. That's got to be pretty significant to have an economic impact. We must be talking about quite a few people that have become believers or at least have been rethinking everything due to the confrontation with the gospel that Paul proclaims. So as Demetrius puts it, the reason this is happening is a considerable number of people have turned away saying that gods made with hands are no gods at all. Now, I don't want to repeat. Some of you have heard this rap before, so I'll give you the brief version. But as I would understand the concept of a god in the ancient world, a god is simply a reality-shaping force. That is, if we ask ourselves the question, why does history go the way history goes? Why does the story of my life go the way it goes? Why do I confront the circumstances that I confront? Why are my circumstances what they are? And the answer that everybody ultimately gives or should give, some moderns don't, but most of us recognize there's something outside of us. There's something bigger than us that shapes our lives and makes our lives go the way our lives go. What is that? Well, we attribute that other thing that transcends us to various things. And in the ancient world, the polytheists believe, well, there's actually a number of reality-shaping forces. There's love, and there's justice, and there's truth, and there's war, and there's this, and there's that. There's the sun, there's the moon, there's this and there's that. All of them, in one way or another, impinge on our lives. And the net result of all of their activity in shaping our lives is what our lives become. They make my life what it is. And the word they used to describe such a force was a god. It seems to me that Judaism and Christianity adopted the word god to describe Yahweh, the ultimate being, the transcendent author of all reality, because it's a very good word to use to describe who God is. God is not just one of many reality-shaping forces. God is the only reality-shaping force in town. He and he alone dictates what happens. He and he alone shapes history. He and he alone determines what happens in my life. Not Satan, not demons, not economics, not love, not war. Yes, those things are reality-shaping forces, but they are reality-shaping forces that do whatever they do only by the will of another, only by the will of he who is. And so the only force in all of reality that's worthy of the name God, the only one who is the God, Allah, that's what Allah means in Islam, is the only one who's really the God is the God, Yahweh. Well, part of the message of Paul, and certainly it would have been implicit in everything that Paul had to say, was there is no God worth worrying about. There is no reality-shaping force in all of reality worth worrying about except the God who created the heavens and the earth, the God of Genesis 1, the God who is the Father of Jesus, the God who is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who made promises to David, this God who made himself known in a unique and special way to the Jews. He's the only one worth worrying about. Well, once you become persuaded of that, all this other stuff that's happening seems like just so much silliness. So they stop buying the shrines, they stop praying to them, they stop bowing to them, scraping to them, they stop paying attention to the temple because there's only one God to worry about. That was the impact. Demetrius and the silversmiths felt that impact in their pocketbook, and they got mad. They were really threatened by that. They were afraid. This is going to undermine my whole livelihood. So he got them together to try to figure out, you know, what are we going to do about this? And out of their rage, out of their anger, they created an energy that literally created a sort of quasi-riot here in Ephesus. At one point, apparently the Jews decide, and I'm not altogether sure except that the problem that Demetrius had with Paul, he would certainly have with Judaism generally. And I think the Jewish leaders in town recognized how dangerous that situation was for themselves. So they put forward a man named Alexander to try to as a spokesman for Judaism, to try to address the crowd. The crowd wouldn't let him speak. Once they recognized that he was a Jew, they began this two-hour chant, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." Finally, the town, they call it the town clerk, that translation doesn't quite capture the authority that he had, the leader of the town, stands up and he says, "Listen, you guys, nobody has committed any crime here. You're not even accusing anybody of any crime. You just don't like what they're teaching. But they are not temple robbers, whatever that is. I still haven't figured out what that word means. But they're not temple robbers. They're not guilty of blaspheming the goddess, Artemis of the Ephesians. If you are saying that they committed a crime, we've got a means of taking care of that. Bring charges against them. Let's take them to court. Let's convict them of the crime if that's the case. We've got institutions set up to do that. So if that's the issue, then let's see you in court. If it's not a crime that's been committed and you want to pass new laws, well, we have an assembly. I don't remember how often they met, once a year or maybe two or three times a year. We have an assembly coming up and you can propose new legislation at that and we'll take care of it that way. But what you're doing here today with this riot are bringing us dangerously close to having Rome come in and take over. That was always a threat in the Roman Empire. If you didn't keep your own house in order, if you didn't keep law and order, if there was chaos happening, Rome had a way of bringing order to the chaos in their own fashion. And in anybody who had any sort of stake in the Ephesian society would not want Rome coming in and bringing order in their own fashion. And so he's threatening them with the prospect that Rome will do that. And that finally quiets the crowd as they contemplate what could result. Along the way, I didn't mention this, the crowd drag with them Gaius and Aristarchus. These guys are both from Thessalonica, I believe. Sorry, that's not true. There, as best I can tell, there seem to be two Gaiuses that are traveling companions of Paul. One is from Derby, and if you remember, Derby was this sort of pagan outpost up in the Galatian region. That's the first place he went where it wasn't so much the Jews that he spoke to, but it was Gentiles, raw pagan Gentiles for the first time. Gaius is from there, one Gaius. There is another Gaius from Corinth, but I don't think that this is he. I think this Gaius is probably the Gaius from Derby. And Aristarchus we meet again shortly, and you see him mentioned in two or three of the Ephesian letters. I'd never even paid attention to the guy, but he seems to have been one of the inner circle of Paul's traveling companions, because he's mentioning him a lot in his benedictions and greetings and stuff. And he's from, I believe, Thessalonica. He's from Thessalonica. Okay, then we go on. This riot occurs. After the uproar had ceased, Paul sent for the disciples, and when he had exhorted them and taken his leave of them, he left to go to Macedonia. When he had gone through those districts and had given them much exhortation, he came to Greece. And there he spent 3 months, and when a plot was formed against him by the Jews as he was about to set sail for Syria, he decided to return through Macedonia. And he was accompanied by Sopater of Berea, the son of Pyrrhus, and by Aristarchus, probably the same Aristarchus that they dragged into the theater in Ephesus, by Aristarchus and Secundus of the Thessalonians, and Gaius of Derbe, and Timothy, and Tychicus and Trophimus of Asia. But these had gone on ahead and were waiting for us at Troas. We sailed from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread and came to them at Troas within 5 days, and there we stayed 7 days. Okay, so what happens after he leaves Ephesus? He leaves Ephesus, he travels through Macedonia, so he traveled north up to Philippi, Berea, Thessalonica. Probably Paul ventured onto the borders of what's called Illyricum, which is probably modern-day Albania, up the peninsula further, because in Romans he mentions that I have proclaimed the gospel from Jerusalem to Illyricum. So it's likely on this trip that he kind of ventured a little further and on up to the frontiers of Macedonia to Illyricum. Then he travels down through Greece to Corinth, stays a while. All this time he's exhorting the churches. I'll come back to that in a second. He's there for, what do you say, 3 months? A few months. And there's a plot against him. So he's about to leave. He has gathered these people that are listed in verse 4. He's gathered these people who are going to accompany him back to Jerusalem, as I was saying earlier. They're going to travel together, but news of a plot against him comes to Paul's attention. So rather than sail on the ship where the plot presumably was going to happen, was going to be enacted, he travels by land. So he retraces his step, travels by land up through Macedonia to Philippi. The rest of his party go ahead and sail, not toward Jerusalem immediately, but they go up to Troas. Troas would be on the northwest coast of modern-day Turkey, across the sea from Philippi. They go to Troas and wait for Paul. Paul travels by land up to Philippi, waits for the festival of the unleavened bread to finish, presumably because he was observing it, and then sails down to Troas and meets his traveling companions. Okay, two things I want to comment on here, and then we're running out of time, so I'll leave it at that. The first thing is, notice Paul's response to the plot against his life. And we see this over and over and over again. Paul sees a plot against his life. He uses his head, he uses his common sense, he uses his rationality to do what he must do to escape the plot. Two things about that are significant, I think. On the one hand, courage is not rash. Courage is not reckless. Paul is very obviously a courageous man. There's no question about that. But you don't show courage by doing something stupid to put yourself in danger. Paul faced danger over and over and over and over again. And he's beaten and he's imprisoned and he's scared out of his mind over and over and over again. But that happens not because he put himself in a dangerous situation. He did everything he could to avoid dangerous situations, but as it happened, sometimes he got caught. And his courage consists not in that kind of macho defiance of harm and death. That's not courage. That's something else. But it's not his macho defiance of these things that made him courageous. It's the fact that he was undeterred. No matter how many times they plotted to kill him, no matter how many times they tried to kill him, no matter how many times they imprisoned him, no matter how many times they scourged him and beat him, no matter how many times his life was in danger, it didn't stop him from doing what God had called him to do. He was going to go one more time, and if danger came, then danger was going to come. But, and so be it. But I've got to do what God has called me to do. And that's his courage. The fact that he obeyed even in the face of the danger. But he wasn't this kind of hyper spiritual, super spiritual person who had a view of faith that said, I will go ahead and sail on the ship and God will protect me. It wasn't his perspective. You never see him modeling that kind of concept of faith. Faith never nullifies rationality and common sense for Paul. You do what you must do. You do it the way it's reasonable to do it, that it's wise to do it. You protect yourself because you ought to protect yourself. And it's fine to protect yourself. But sometimes all of your attempts at protecting yourself aren't going to keep you from harm. And what are you going to do about that? Well, you have the courage to go ahead and do what you need to do anyway, even if harm comes. And that's the nature of his courage and the character of his faith. His faith was not the kind of faith that where Satan tempted Jesus, jump off this pinnacle, 1,500 feet to your death. God will send his angels to bear you up. And Jesus says, no, that would be stupid. That's not faith, that's stupidity. And then what was my second point? What does he mean here in 2? When he had gone through those districts and given them much exhortation, he came to Greece. We're going to come in a second to a passage where I think we have exactly the kind of thing that he must have been saying to all these people anywhere he went, because we're going to have a scene coming up where he talks to, we have a reenactment of the message that he gave to the Ephesian elders, and it's this exhortation. So we'll wait till we get there, but that's what it means by exhorting them. Exhorting does not mean comfort. It does not mean encourage. It means persuading them that this truth is so true and is so significant and it's so important that you'd be a fool to give up on it. You'd be a fool to abandon it. I don't care how hard it gets. I don't care what kind of persecution you face. I don't care how much life disappoints you and crushes you. You'd be a fool to give up on this truth because it's true. And it's the truth about ultimate realities, ultimate fulfillment, ultimate blessing, eternal life itself. So that will always be the essential core message of exhortation, would be hang in there, keep the faith, don't give up, because this is true. Okay, in order for you to have any time, I better stop now. So your questions or comments?
Jack, could you comment on, in verse 26, where Paul, you know, they're saying that Paul has said that they are not gods which are made with hands, contrasted with 37, what the clerk says, they're not blaspheming your goddess.
Yeah.
I mean, what more could you say that wouldn't be blasphemy? Are we not studying, understanding the mindset? And that's always been curious to me. So did you come up with anything on that?
Yeah, I don't. That is very curious, because in my mind that would seem like blasphemy. But probably blasphemy is an actual explicit, it would be to stand up and say, Artemis of the Ephesians is an idiot, or something, some explicit insult directed at the god or goddess. That must be the case. Otherwise, the ideas that Paul is presenting are clearly so derogatory, that is, Artemis of the Ephesians doesn't exist, is sort of an insult. You know. So I would think of it as blasphemy, but evidently it doesn't qualify by the law. You know, whatever the law on the books was, it wasn't actually by the legal definition of blasphemy, I would assume.
That's my city next door. You mentioned the issue that this Artemis is not the well-known Artemis, and I'm just wondering how that works with verse 27, where it says that she whom all of Asia and the world worship.
No, she was well-known. I misspoke if I said otherwise. She was very well-known, I think. I think that's true. But she's simply a different goddess from the Artemis in the Greek pantheon. What I probably meant is the Artemis that's well-known to us is the Artemis of the Greek pantheon. But the Artemis of the Ephesians was well-known throughout the Roman Empire.
This isn't meant as a challenging question. Just what's the basis of...
Just everybody, every article I've read about it. I mean, they've dug up the temple. I mean, it's there's no question but what there was a religious worship centered in Ephesus around this goddess Artemis. And there's no question about that. Well, yeah, but okay, I see the nature of your question. We've read Herodotus in Gutenberg, and when you read Herodotus, one of the things that he's taking great pains to show is, let's see, how does it go? You know, nothing is worth anything if it's not Greek. So he reads Egyptian culture. He's giving us a history of the Egyptian culture. He's looking at Egyptian culture through Greek eyes. So they have all these gods that have Egyptian names, but Herodotus' impulse is to say, well, that, of course, is so-and-so, and that, of course, is so-and-so, and giving them their gods' Greek names. I think that's what the Greeks tended to do, is they simply assumed our worldview is the one and only worldview. So if you're worshiping a god or a goddess somewhere else in the empire, you're just worshiping one of our gods by a different name. I mean, what else could you be doing? Because our gods are the gods, so what else could you be doing? Presumably it was out of that kind of impulse that this goddess received the name Artemis. Well, that just is Artemis. Now, the differences between that goddess and the goddess in the Greek pantheon were of little concern to them. I mean, coherence and consistency at that point was a lot less important. I mean, their pantheons and their mythology is so complex anyway that who could remember whether they're the same? So it probably, the fact of the matter is, they were sort of identical, but not really. I mean, that what they do know about the Artemis of the Ephesians doesn't really match very well the mythology about the Artemis in the Greek pantheon. But I don't think that would keep your common ordinary person from thinking, well, they're one and the same thing. So, yeah, they sort of are the same, but not really, I think, is the picture. Diana is the Roman equivalent. Yeah, exactly. So your translation is Diana? Yeah. Yeah, it's Artemis in Greek, in the Greek text, but they've just decided to translate it into the Roman goddess that corresponds to that. I don't know why.
Jack, in the very beginning, you were in verse 21, you were talking about the decision-making process that Paul used, and as opposed to the Lord led me here, the Lord led me there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, coming ahead, I'm going ahead to when he actually departs, it's not. We haven't covered that in the text yet, but my Bible had a footnote to go to this next place. I'm not trying to come off as a scripture jockey here, but the place that it did send me ahead to is where he does leave Ephesus, and he goes. It's in 20:22, and then he talks about the next step in going to Jerusalem. It says, and now compelled by the Spirit, I'm going to Jerusalem. So as opposed to I've decided to go to Jerusalem, right about when he does go to Jerusalem, he says, now compelled by the Spirit. So,
yeah, my translation has bound in spirit, and I think that's a better translation of the sense. I think it means the same thing. Bound in spirit there means the same thing as in 21, he purposed in the Spirit to go to Jerusalem. That is, he had this burden. Yeah, that bound in spirit, I think, is, I don't care what happens to me there, I got to do this. That's what I think of. That's what I think bound in spirit means. And then, I'll comment on this next week. But the striking thing is, if you were to try to decipher the message of the Spirit of God, it would be, don't go to Jerusalem. Paul goes anyway. So stick that in your pietistic pipe and smoke it. I mean, is he being disobedient? Is he being disobedient to the Spirit? We'll talk about that next week.
A couple of things you didn't comment on, I just thought I'd ask. I don't think this contradicts what you were saying about Paul's attitude towards danger, but you didn't mention the part in the story with the riot where he wanted to go in and mm-hmm. they said he wouldn't. So I was just wondering how you read what he was thinking and what they were thinking and how that fits with what you were saying about his attitude towards danger.
Well, I don't think he knew whether that would have been reckless or not. I mean, he didn't know how to assess the danger there. On the one hand, he sees what a great opportunity. On the other hand, it's dangerous. And he finally listens to the counsel of his friends who are saying, Paul, it's dangerous. And he finds himself keeping their counsel at that point. But he's tempted to go in, and I think the reason he's tempted to go in is because his mission is to reach Gentiles for Jesus. And you got a whole lot of Gentiles gathered together with a lot of energy. maybe I can proclaim the gospel to them. Paul, here and again in Jerusalem, I don't think he's reckless, but I think he tends to be optimistic. If I can just have a chance to speak to them, maybe they will listen. You see the same thing in the temple in Jerusalem in a few chapters. You know, the guy is whisking him away. The soldiers have to carry them on their shoulders to keep the mob from tearing him to pieces. They have to carry him out of there on their shoulders. They're marching up the stairs into the fortress to keep him safe. And he says, could I talk to him? Could I talk to him? And he turns around and talks to him. And, of course, create the riot by what he has to say. But he just seems to have this perspective that there's an opportunity here. I have to take this opportunity. And that's part of his courage, I think. I mean, why would I pass up an opportunity just because it might be dangerous? I wouldn't want to do that. So there you see his courage. But on the other hand, when it comes to his attention, they have a plot against you and they're going to kill you secretly. Then I'll change my plans.
Well, was part of his motivation the fact that his two traveling companions were already dragged in there?
Could be.
I mean, if he
could
sees, be. Here, my friends are being dragged in there, and it's really me they want. I mean,
yeah.
Part of his
spot, I noticed as you were reading, as we came into 20, that he started to talk about we mm-hmm. left. Is this the spot where that starts?
Yes. Well, there's two places. It started once earlier, and then it starts again here.
And what do you conclude from that?
I don't know. I've debated back and forth. The problem, some people have the perspective that Luke has been left behind and is not, probably back in Macedonia, and so he's not with Paul during all this intervening time, and that he rejoins him right here. That's entirely possible and certainly likely, given that. But on the one hand. On the other hand, I don't know. Maybe that's right. But he seems to have such intimate detail of the stuff that intervene that either he's just a really good investigative reporter or he was actually an eyewitness to these things. I'm not sure which. He was a good investigative reporter, we know from the Gospels, so that might be the answer to it.
Yeah.
I mean, he did a lot of research to put this together. So I don't have a firm conclusion about that. Time for one more.
Do you have any clue what happened to his companions? Do they mention anywhere later?
Uh-huh. Let's see. Aristarchus is mentioned again in, well, twice here, and I didn't record it. I didn't write it down, but I mentioned in several letters he's mentioned as traveling with Timothy or with Titus or somebody else. Secundus is only mentioned here. Let me see. Tychicus and Trophimus both are mentioned a number of different places. And then we have other, I think this list here are not all the traveling companions. I think the thing that we, when you put two and two together, the thing that you discover is when it lists somebody as traveling with him, it's not the only one traveling with him. That there are all kinds of people that are traveling with him. Luke, for one, only we know that just because of the we wouldn't know that any other way. And you hear people, I mean, we wouldn't have known that, Erastus, we would have no way of knowing that he was in Ephesus traveling with him, except that it mentions he was sent up to Macedonia. So there's all kinds of clues that there's more going on here than Luke makes explicit. So I think these people are listed simply because these are the representatives of their churches to represent those churches to Jerusalem on this mission that Paul has. There were probably other people traveling with him that just weren't sort of the chosen representatives of the Asian and Greek churches. I didn't study this in detail, but as I just kind of browsed around looking for these names elsewhere, it was astonishing to me the picture that emerged, a picture that I've never had before, and that is this was a very, very active network of people who were traveling hither and yon all the time in different combinations of them, going here and there and everywhere to minister to the churches, to teach and serve and exhort the churches. Excuse me. So there are a lot of unsung heroes among this early church, people that probably had a significant, powerful impact on people's lives, and we don't even know their names, or barely know their names. But we don't know, I don't know detailed biographies, but their names do keep, several of them, their names keep emerging. So, okay, we'll pick it up here next week.